Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. Today, we're talking about the film I, Tonya. The film chronicles the career of figure skater Tonya Harding, who's played by Margot Robbie.
Harding was a U.S. champion and an Olympian. She was also part of one of the biggest sports scandals of the 20th century, a 1994 attack on her rival, Nancy Kerrigan, that was traced back to Harding's husband and, perhaps, to the skater herself.
The injury to Kerrigan's leg is only one element of the film, which chronicles Harding's difficult upbringing in the company of her mother, played by Allison Janney, and her volatile marriage to Jeff Galooly, played by Sebastian Stan.
Allison Janney just won a Golden Globe for her performance, and both Robbie and Janney have been in most of the major awards conversations in the lead-up to the Oscars. I'm Stephen Thompson.
Also joining us are Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And Margaret Willison, co-host of the Appointment Television podcast and one of the writers of the Two Bossy Dames newsletter. She's up there in Boston. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, guys.
I am going to go first in this conversation to Glenn. Mm-hmm. What, Glenn, were your feelings about this story going into this film, and how did they change, if they did, coming out of it?
They changed between the trailer and the movie. Boy, I love this trailer. I like the movie.
Yeah.
The trailer, it's making the assumption that you know the story, so it's pitching you on the execution and the style, which this film has a lot of, and it entices you, enticed me, to other people might be off-putting, but it enticed you with a combination of sort of archness, I don't want to call it camp, but mm-hmm. archness and glibness, which, you know, they're my sun and moon. They're
yeah.
my alpha and omega. And I thought I was getting early Coen Brothers, I thought I was getting Drop Dead Gorgeous, I thought I was getting the positively true adventures of the alleged Texas cheerleading murdering mom. That's
right,
what I
yeah.
thought we were going to be. 30% of this film is that. The rest is different. In the trailer, there's this part where Tonya Harding shoots a shotgun after Jeff Galooly running away, and then she turns to the camera and she said, I never did this, you know? And I thought we were going to be getting a lot of that wall-to-wall that. We didn't. And I'm still thinking about this film because I saw it weeks ago. I'm still thinking about this film because I couldn't quite get a handle on it. The domestic abuse is depicted very flatly, unsparingly, very ugly, and not just because it's scored by Foghat, but that does not help.
Yeah.
And yet the central crime is played strictly, strictly for laughs. And the victim of this crime is not even depicted. This is a conscious choice. But what that did was it kind of set up this really whiplashy tone that I'm still trying to figure out. So I want to hear what you guys thought about this, because I do not have a nice, neat little reaction to this film.
Okay, Steven, same question. How about you?
Yeah, I'm a little bit in the same camp as Glenn. I definitely found, when you're looking for comparisons tone-wise, Glenn, the movies that jumped to my mind were The Disaster Artist,
yeah.
and more to the point, The Big Short, mm-hmm. which actually also has Margot Robbie in it. But The Big Short has this kind of where it stops and explains, and there's a kind of a lightning to it and a little bit of a silliness to it. And for this film, that makes a certain amount of sense. But at the same time, they clearly made the decision, and I think it's the right decision, where they had to show the domestic abuse. They had to establish, as part of the film's central thesis, that Tonya Harding has spent her entire life up to the point of the attack surrounded entirely by nincompoops and abusers. Mm-hmm. So they have to show the abuse. But at the same time, that does make the tone wobble a little bit, because you have this mix of very, very serious stuff and this kind of lightness, this fourth wall breaking, this very, very insistent soundtrack, which mm-hmm. I found extremely distracting, mm-hmm. especially when it's so on the nose that it's like showing Allison Janney being awful to the strains of Devil Woman,
yeah.
or How Can You Mend a Broken Heart when they're going through the divorce stuff, or a use of Dream a Little Dream that so like narrates the scene happening, like word for word narrates the scene that's happening. That stuff creates a little bit of a mishmash. Like you, Glenn, I'm still thinking about the movie, and I liked the movie, and it's sort of caused me to go back and research the story more. Ultimately, on balance, I recommend it. I thought Margot Robbie was terrific in it, and Allison Janney, of course, is great, but it's uneven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Margaret, how about you?
I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Allison Janney obsessive. I've loved everything she's ever done. So I was in on this movie the second I saw the first still of her in a fur coat with a parrot on her shoulder with those glasses. The experience I had of watching the film is very different than what I was expecting going in, and I just found it shockingly heartbreaking. I am the youngest person on this podcast today, and I was familiar with the story, but not at all familiar with Tonya Harding's career independent of it. And I felt like this movie makes such an effective case for her remarkable athletic ability, for the system that was designed to discriminate against her, and for just like the crushing defeat when the ruling comes down and she is not allowed to skate ever again for the rest of her life. That scene hit me so much harder than I was expecting anything in this movie to hit. So I completely agree with all of the stuff that everyone is saying about the unevenness of the tone of the film and uncertainty about some of the aspects of execution. But there was a core here that really landed with me.
Yeah. So for me, the major precursor to this film is the 30 for 30 documentary called The Price of Gold, which was directed by Nanette Burstein, came out through ESPN a couple of years ago. And what I like so much about that film is that the purpose of that film is to re-examine the story of both Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan, to look at this scandal, this incident, as it were, and really to make the point that the entire skating system is so flawed because it was awful for both of them. It's right. Essentially, it's terrible if you become the person that they don't favor, but it's also terrible if you become the person who's treated as sort of princessy and, you know, favored in a way like Nancy Kerrigan was. Because if you remember, what happened after those Olympics was that Nancy Kerrigan was immediately ripped to shreds for being ungrateful and bratty, for saying what I considered to be normal human. You know, you get caught in a Disney parade saying it's corny to be in a Disney parade. Of course it's corny to be in a Disney parade. And it's the kind of thing that nobody cares about when other athletes do it.
Right.
So I felt like the Burstein documentary, which, and Stephen and I were talking about this earlier, is pretty clearly one of the inspirational pieces for this film. And I think the director, you know, the people behind this film have acknowledged it. I thought that was a really interesting film because its purpose was not to make you sympathetic to Tonya Harding. Its purpose was to say she had a terrible life. Nancy Kerrigan had a difficult life in other ways because she was not a wealthy. She was set up to be sort of like she was a rich girl and a prep or whatever, or prissy. And Nancy Kerrigan was from a blue collar, you know, family also. So I'm more interested in examinations of that system and its inequities than I am a Tonya Harding redemption tour. And all of this is my way of saying the more this film has evolved into a Tonya Harding redemption tour, including bringing her to the Golden Globes and sort of having her blow kisses to the crowd. And now she's going back on television once again, as she has many times before, to complain about how poorly she was treated. The more that happens, the less I like it. And the more I find myself cringing away from it, because for me, you can acknowledge her history of abuse, both domestic in terms of her husband and domestic in terms of, you know, potentially her mother, without feeling like she's a nice person. That's kind of the whole point of the documentary, is you don't have to like her or think she's a nice person. And I don't, to understand that she's a victim of abuse, if that makes sense.
Sure, I hear that.
And so the more it has evolved into being very pro her, the less I have liked it and appreciated its presence, I guess.
I think a couple of things that Tonya does that the documentary isn't able to do. One, you have the power of these performances. You also have a really vivid picture of the clowns around her. I thought its depiction of the crime as this just bumbling exercise in idiots being idiots, first of all, is played, as Glenn said, for humor, but it's also just very, very vividly rendered in ways that a documentary, which just has the footage of Nancy Kerrigan crying to go on, I thought that's all the stuff with Sean Eckhart, the bodyguard, that performance by Paul Walter Hauser is so terrific and so consistent with the footage that you see of Sean Eckhart. It's able to do some dramatization in ways I found powerful. And the 30 for 30 documentary, which has much more of Nancy Kerrigan than is in I, Tonya. I, Tonya replaces that with lots and lots of the relationship between Tonya Harding and her mother. And that gives you some big chewy, powerful scenes.
Yeah, it does. But I'm approaching this as purely as a Hollywood construct because I didn't see the documentary and I don't know this much about this story. I didn't care. and, you know, the mom's a monster is played by Allison Janney. And I didn't need any daylight there. I didn't need to know why she's a monster. And yet, this is a Hollywood construct, right? So the mom's going to get some speech at the end where she has a little bit of redemption. Now, to be fair, the needle doesn't move very much.
No.
But you don't hire Allison Janney. You don't get Allison Janney if there's no arc at all in this character. So I was waiting for it. I was with the kind of white knuckle grip, waiting for it to be this sort of revelatory thing. And it's not. And I appreciate that. But ultimately, to me, here's my bullpoop theory. Comedy can speak to a thing like class in America, which this film thinks it's concerned with, which I'm not entirely sure it's as concerned with it as it, yeah. as it thinks it is. It can speak incisively and universally, and it can expose something. And drama has a different function, really. Drama is about establishing empathy, right? So it's unfair to compare this to a different film, but let's compare this to The Florida Project, right? Mm-hmm. Where both the comedy and the drama are working in concert to make the comedy funnier and the empathy deeper, because I think it has a different attitude toward this class of people than something like The Florida Project does, which it's doing very intentionally.
Right.
But when I hear Allison Janney say, you know, when she, in her speech, in her Golden Globe acceptance speech, that this film is about class in America, I don't think it's working on the level that it thinks it is.
Yeah. What are you thinking, yeah. Margaret?
I definitely agree that the stuff with class is really thorny. Because on some level, they are making a very persuasive argument about how unfair perceptions of Tanya Harding are connected to her class. But then it also seems to want to traffic in some of the fun and pappiness of how those unfair assumptions exist in our mind. It seems to want me, a middle-class white girl who is very much the depiction of the coastal elite, to be like, yeah, rednecks, right? And I don't know that it's not necessarily depicting those people with empathy. It's sort of depicting them with like, gee whiz, isn't this fun? It's a very strange line that it's straddling there.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think there is something about this movie that I find unsettling is that there is no question that there's a ton of good material about how skating, perhaps unlike any other sport that besides maybe gymnastics, emphasizes the image of the athlete in such a specific and classed way. And I'm sure people will come up with other examples of sports. And
But with the costuming,
you know, all the stuff about her costumes being kind of handmade and people saying they weren't good enough, that's all real. And that I'm really interested in. And it's almost a shame. Like, I don't want the empathy that you feel for her as somebody who didn't have the class indicators necessary to get respect in that sport. I don't want anybody to assume that that kind of empathy means that you overlook the crime that was committed.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's very,
yeah.
It's extremely condescending to people who live in any economic circumstance to suggest that it's natural for them,
right,
when they're going to lose at skating to go out and try to injure someone else. Because I guarantee you there are a gazillion skaters who could not afford what they needed to compete who would never, you know, ponder anything like that. So if you believe, and the film is sort of not saying, right, if you believe that she was involved in this plot or whatever, which she's always said she wasn't, then it doesn't matter that the fact that you had this very difficult life does not then turn around and make that a natural and normal response.
I don't think that I came out of the movie thinking Tanya Harding was a good person who'd been done wrong. I think I came out of the movie with just like a crushing sense of like the cost of abuse on a person's life.
Right.
There's one line she says where she says, you know, she's talking about experiencing domestic abuse, Tanya Harding or Margot Robbie as Tanya Harding, where she says, you know, Nancy Kerrigan gets hit once and the entire nation poops itself. But for me, it was an everyday occurrence. And it was that sense of just how constant her own bodily harm had been for her and how diminished her access to the idea of herself as a vulnerable person or of people of deserving of respect. Like, that really hit me. I don't even know if the movie meant for it to hit me with this deep well of empathy that it seems to have triggered.
I think it does.
I can't tell.
I think it does.
But I definitely didn't think, like, gee, this Tanya, she's a great person. I thought, man, abuse sucks. Yeah.
And it's probably not fair, you know, on my part to blame the film for the fact that I'm tired of seeing her on television.
Yeah, I mean, I do want to say, I don't want to get out of this discussion without talking a little bit about Margot Robbie's performance specifically, because I thought, I mean, obviously she's being nominated for all the awards. It's an acclaimed performance, but I think it's actually kind of a special performance. And I say that,
yeah.
I watched this movie not right around the same time I watched The Post. And when we talked about The Post, I brought up this point where I never, ever once for a millisecond forgot I was watching Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks. And I found that frustrating. In this, Margot Robbie, a very, very, very glamorous actress who does not look like Tanya Harding, managed to transform herself in a way that I constantly forgot I was watching Margot Robbie. And I think that and the physicality of this performance and the vividness of the characterization, I think it's a marvelous, marvelous performance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the scenes between she and Allison Janney are just, some of them are just stunning. I find them really layered and interesting. The final scene between the pair of them in particular, where Allison Janney's come in with a covert goal and a stated position of empathy that has never previously existed in their relationship. The way all of those impulses were displayed and balanced was, I thought, brilliant.
Yeah, and I do think there's some wonderful costume, hair,
yeah,
production design stuff going on, because it's not the kind of, it's not just the kind of over the top, you know, it's the early 90s, it's the late 80s kind
right.
of stuff. But there are some, when they're trying to capture like what a girl like that would have looked like, not
yeah.
just around the time that this quote unquote incident happened, but earlier, like in the late 80s, it's like there are some moments where you're just like, boy, that is it. It is that hair. It is those braces. Mm-hmm. It is impressive. It is impressive. I agree with Stephen and with Margaret that I think the Margot Robbie performance is great.
Mm-hmm.
I do think Glenn's comparison to The Florida Project is a really telling one. I think both are movies that are trying to tell a story to build empathy with really difficult women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's remarkable about The Florida Project that's not quite there for me with I, Tanya, is The Florida Project manages to depict the incredible vitality and also the complexity of its characters without ever making them into, like, icons
right.
in a way that's problematic. Whereas I, Tanya sort of wants me to, like, get a T-shirt stating that, like, I'm Team Tanya.
Yeah.
Free
and
Tanya.
Does want her to be, yeah, wants her to be sort of this, like, poppy, glammy pop culture icon, wants her to be somebody I'm going to see on RuPaul's Drag Race,
mm-hmm.
the Snatch Game next year.
That's
oh
a great
God.
Point.
And I feel like that sucks some of the energy out of the empathy that other parts of the story are creating. It's kind of at odds with itself.
I think that's a great point. Yeah. Well, tell us what you thought of I, Tanya. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Showtime. From Lena Waithe and Academy Award winner Common comes a new Showtime original series, The Chi, which is about life on the South Side of Chicago, where the people and families of this vibrant community face consequences and hope as their lives intersect. Don't miss The Chi, now streaming. New subscribers can try a free month of Showtime by going to Showtime.com and entering code POPCULTURE. Offer expires February 1st.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Madewell, the women's clothing brand where the motto is good days start with great jeans. Get $20 off a new pair of great jeans when you bring an old pair from any brand into a Madewell store for recycling. Like the ones with bedazzled pockets or your boyfriend's old relaxed fits from before you met him, or the white jeans you doused with red wine. Madewell works with Blue Jeans Go Green to turn them into housing insulation for communities in need. More at madewell.com/denim recycling.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, we just had our resolutions and predictions episode,
sure
in
did.
Which I resolved that in 2018, I would, among other things, watch horror movies with my horror movie loving daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And we, at least week one, we hit our mark and we sat down together on the couch, lit a fire in the fireplace, and watched Shaun of the Dead, which is so, so fun. It's Edgar Wright, who obviously had a big year with Baby Driver. It's Simon Pegg. It's all of the Edgar Wright people. It is a zombie comedy?
Yep.
A zombie?
I wouldn't say that. That's not a thing I would say.
But it scratched so many itches. You know, for my daughter, it scratched watching people get disemboweled.
Yep.
In a few cases, in very, very memorable and scarring ways.
Yep.
But it also is filled with, and I'm going to channel my inner Glenn Weldon when I say jokes.
Yay.
It has jokes. And I particularly loved and treasured, and obviously many, many people listening are already huge fans of this movie. If you haven't seen it, I'm recommending it. But there's this wonderful running gag in the first 30 minutes of this movie where they're hinting at the zombie apocalypse, but they're never addressing it. It's just happening in the background, and he's just so immersed in his life that he doesn't see it. It's such a wonderfully silly take on the zombie movies. I tend to find zombie movies a little bit just kind of dire.
Mm-hmm.
For obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of hope in zombie movies.
Mm-hmm.
This one gets around some of those complaints so, so well. We just had an absolute blast together. Shaun of the Dead.
Yep.
Thank
definitely.
You very much, Stephen Thompson. What fun. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Slow Burn, a podcast about Watergate, is exactly that. It's a Slate podcast hosted by Leon Neyfakh, and it is 8 episodes long. And it's about how Watergate unfolded, how it felt in real time, and how long it took to kind of find a foothold in the American consciousness.
Mm.
And it uses recordings from the time, contemporary interviews to flesh out the way it was, how slowly that affair took on the shape that we now read about in history books. And, you know, it's really well done. We're about 6 episodes out of the 8 in, so it's a great binge if you want to catch up. So that's Slow Burn, a podcast about Watergate.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Margaret H. Hula Hoop Willison Esquire, not really. What is making you happy this week?
What is making me personally happy this week is that one of my very favorite television shows of all time has come back to a legal streaming platform. The television show in question is Slings and Arrows.
Sure.
It's so dead center in Pop Culture Happy Hour's interests that I'm sure there are so many people out there who've already listened to it, in which case I'm here to tell you the good news. It is back. It's on YouTube. It is on a channel called Encore Plus. It's completely free. Thank you, Canadian Media Fund. For those of you who don't know, it is a dramedy set behind the scenes of a Shakespeare festival at a fictional place called New Burbage, Canada. And the premise is that the famous lead, who has now gone off and founded his own very, very poor theater, has come back and become the artistic director of this festival in the wake of the previous director's death. The previous director drove him to a nervous breakdown during Hamlet. He is being forced to direct Hamlet, and he is being haunted by the ghost of the former director, whom only he can see. It is so good. If you care about theater, watch it. If you like Shakespeare, watch it. If you like Due South, Paul Gross also stars in this.
Uh-huh.
Watch it. Please watch it. And then, if you like it, track down my TV podcast, Appointment Television, because we are going to be doing a series on this because I have been waiting so long to make my hosts watch it. And I couldn't be more excited.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Margaret Willison. Before I get to my happy, I will quickly note, if you are interested in hearing me talk at length about anxiety and depression, I was on John Moe's show, The Hilarious World of Depression. You can catch up
Yay.
With that.
Nice.
What is actually making me happy this week? I was sick recently, spent a few days pretty much lying around the house. and watching Cupcake Wars and Cake Wars, both baking shows on the Food Network. The basic structure of Cupcake Wars is that there is a theme each week, and you might think it would be like a big major theme, and sometimes it is. It'll be like Dr. Seuss, but sometimes it'll be like, it's the new Angry Birds in Space game, and that'll be what the whole episode they're making cupcakes about Angry Birds in Space. So sometimes the themes really seem like they came out of some kind of synergy that I don't really know exactly how it works, but they have to make a whole bunch of different cupcakes, and there's cooking and there's decorating, and in no way is it as good as Bake Off. It is nothing like that. It is much more. Somebody actually asked me when I was talking about this, is that a real thing? I thought it was just on Master of None. It's the thing that Aziz Ansari winds up hosting. But no, Cupcake Wars is real, and I enjoy watching it because occasionally people are allowed to fail, and that's what I really like in my cooking shows. Like, sometimes you make a cupcake and it just is no good and nobody likes it, and sometimes the theme ingredients result in a cupcake that is not that different from, if you remember the Friends episode where Rachel made a trifle that had a layer of meat with peas and onions. They're not that different from that. Sometimes they'll be like, oh yes, this cupcake has a guacamole frosting. And you'll be like, ooh. But then the host, the judge will say, oh, actually, I was afraid it would not be good, but it's delicious, actually. So Cupcake Wars and Cake Wars on demand, making me happy this week while lying around my house. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can, of course, follow Margaret Willison at Mrs. Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music you are making cupcakes to right now. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. If you have a second and you're so inclined, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more people to find the show, and we will see all of you next week.